a tremendous amount of back and forth was going on. The British and the French were determined, we'll talk self-determination, but what we're really going to do is to destroy empires and make sure that they're eating out of our hand and dependent on us. We'll create corporations jointly with these countries. So one still has, like, British Petroleum. They don't call themselves, now they just call themselves BP. But what does that mean, British Petroleum? That was Britain's corporation throughout the Mideast that controlled a tremendous amount of the world's oil for a certain point. And they took it away from Germany and from the Ottoman cooperation with Germany. So this was something that was going on. But as I said, every country came and asked its due. There was Chaim Weizmann, the leading Zionist of his time. He saw that there was a lot going on in the higher circles of the British aristocracy concerning Palestine, which was now liberated from the Ottoman Empire. What was going to happen to Palestine? Certainly it was oil poor, but strategically it was right near the Suez Canal. It bordered Egypt. It was in northern Africa, in the Jordan Rift and so on, the African Rift. Many, many things about this little spot of land, smaller than New Jersey, as we keep hearing, very, very important to the British. And essentially, what the higher-ups in the British government determined, they didn't all agree on this, but many did, we want this to be a Jewish state. Why? Not out of our tremendous love for the Jews in Britain. In fact, this will be an excuse to get a lot of them out of Britain and somewhere else, because they are our people. They have European educations. They speak perfect English. They're smart. They're good with money. They know how to make deals. If we have them in this spot of the Mideast, they will represent our interests. They will make Israel English. And that's what we want. So they were exerting tremendous pressure, supporting Zionism very strongly. By the way, Theodor Herzl, some years before, who really originated very much the idea of Zionism, like many people of his time, went to Rudolf Steiner to ask him advice. And he said, should I help to start a homeland for the Jews? The British are saying that it might be possible for Palestine to be our homeland once again. That's where we belong, and we may be able to get it. And Steiner said, no, you should not do that. And Herzl was taken aback. Why? And what Steiner said is frighteningly prescient. He said, it is not good for Jews to concentrate themselves. He said, this is always a tendency. Either they're forced to concentrate by emperors and kings and to form into ghettos, or they choose to. He said, there are many Jews in Europe right now who don't have to live in the same neighborhood, but choose to do that. He said, this is not good. And Herzl said, well, what is good then? What should the Jews be doing? And Steiner said they should be spread throughout the world and act as leavening for the world. They should help things bubble up as leavening. So here, however, that was not to be, or I mean, it sort of is, but the homeland was to form. Right before the war ended, Weizmann got himself decked up in an Arab costume. He had a dark beard. He looked just like a Bedouin, and got himself smuggled in to a part of southern Syria, which was still war-torn, as it is today, but different combatants. And there he met with Prince Faisal. The prince's father was a powerful emirati, a powerful sheikh, for the land that was Palestine at this time. And Weizmann, who had already been communicating by cable and by letter with Prince Faisal, they worked out an agreement in which Prince Faisal wrote that we have no quarrel with the Jews coming to Palestine. We look forward to being back with our brothers once again. And here we have the wonderful poem that Raimunda did of this common root of Abraham to both of these people. And we think, in fact, that the Jews from Europe, they will be a model for us. They'll teach us how we can really govern ourselves in the right way, how we can develop jobs for our people and not be nomads. It was beautiful, beautifully written letter. And you know, we know that there are many countries that hate the Jews. We do not. We want them with us. And he said, all that we ask is that we have autonomy, that we are able to carry on our lives as before in brotherhood with the Jews, and that we can be self-governing in sections of Palestine. And Weizmann said, this is no problem. I will be glad to bring this back to my fellow Jews and to the British who will help us with this. So he brought it back. Now, Faisal wrote all of this in Arabic. Well, it had to be translated. T. Lawrence happened to be around, and he was superb, totally fluent in many dialects of Arabic. He easily translated it, and then he translated the letter sent by the British as well. Back and forth these letters went. Finally, the final agreement, which was written then in early January, as the Paris Peace Conference was going on, added that the Jews would have complete domain in Palestine, that there would not be an autonomous state, that Arabs living in Israel would be governed by the Jews, that the British, as they had wished from day one, had a Jewish state, a European-like state, where the Arabs would be treated well, humanely, but basically second-class people. So Faisal read this, and T. Lawrence translated it, kind of softened the whole thing a bit, but Faisal said, this is not what I agreed to. And Lawrence said, well, don't worry, you know, these are diplomats. These things go back and forth. This isn't a treaty. It's just agreements. We're just negotiating. Just sign it, sign it. So Faisal signed it, but he said, I'm writing something to express that this is not what I agreed with Chaim Weizmann. I haven't heard from him for a long time, but this is not our agreement. I want it to be known that we want autonomy. Yes, yes, Lord, go ahead, write that. That's very important. Good, very, very good. Somehow, the document that was received at the Paris Peace Conference, which had to give the go-ahead for all of this, did not have Faisal's caveat on it. His words were nowhere to be found. T. Lawrence somehow forgot. He only translated back from the Arabic what basically Faisal had been given by the English, and that was that. And of course, Faisal and his father and the whole group were shocked and distressed at what had gone on. It didn't even really dawn on them what the consequences would be. And of course, then, for the next 30 years, this was still not Israel per se. This was still a mandate. The peace conference gave the British that land to kind of be its protectorate. They would look after things. They'd help the Jews form a European-like government. They'd keep the peace between the Jews and the Arabs and so on. And of course, that was to lead then to the many disasters preceding 1948 when the British withdrew. And kind of the invention of modern terrorism arose from that, though it wasn't the Arabs who were terrorists, it was the Jews trying to get the British out. So there we have it. What's going on in the Mideast right now as I talk began in these conversations and in this intrigue in 1919, and was then articulated and codified, put into law, as it were, international law, in the Paris Peace Conference. At the same time, in China, a group of students on May 4th, 1919, protested the fact that the German part of China, which was no longer German, had been given by the peace conference to Japan as its own territory. And the Chinese said, wait a second, this has been going on already for 100 years that Europe decides this or that is theirs. Now our enemies, the Japanese, are getting something as well. And the largest protests ever seen in China in history arose on May 4th. Holiday was just celebrated in China, today's China, but not a big celebration, because as it happens, the students gathered in Tiananmen Square in Beijing, which was to be the scene of another set of great protests later on, and the government would rather forget about all of that. And there were horrible, horrible interactions on these May 4th protests in 1919. And finally, they were driven back. However, the leaders, though they were imprisoned for a short period of time, were released, and one of them went on then to become the co-founder of the Communist Party of China. So here again, what happens then? 1949, 30 years later, Mao Zedong takes the Great March and China becomes a communist country. Out of the beginnings in 1919. So what a year. What a year. That's why I call it discord, plenty of that. And destiny. We are still living out the destiny. What went on May 4th, 1919 is going to make your next computer more expensive. It's going to make that new lamp that you need for your house impossible to buy. What happened then on May 4th is what leads to these conflicts between the West and China, which could have been solved, which could have been worked for. But Woodrow Wilson of the United States, Lloyd George of England, and Georges Clemenceau of France were not about to have it that way. They were going to replace the old, as one anthroposophist was to say later, with the even older. They were going to break up the world into an even more chaotic and fragmented way, because that served their purposes. That really served their needs very, very well. And just one more consequence of this, going on as the January peace talks were going on, Germany now, in the wake of the end of the war, was also in a state of complete chaos. Now, something that we don't realize very much, and it's interesting, histories of World War I often don't make enough of this. If you were a German living in Berlin or in Bonn or anywhere, even in the countryside, as far as you knew, Germany was winning the war. Germany had lost some significant battles, but again and again went back and beat the French, overcame the British, and even was meeting the Americans, who had greater numbers and fresh soldiers, was beating them back again and again. Germany's propaganda industry was incredible, and it was only to get that much better under Hitler, of course. But World War I was where all of the nations mastered the art of propaganda, took control of the media, and began to produce what we would call today fake news, but real fake news. This stuff was really phony, with fake maps and things like that. And the radio, people in Germany didn't have the BBC to listen to in those days, as they were to have in World War II when they could. So they knew nothing but what they were told. Travel was almost impossible in those days to leave a country that was at war. except if you were a soldier. There were mass desertions going on among the Germans. There were, again, tremendous malnutrition among the troops, wounds that couldn't be treated because there weren't enough painkillers, there weren't enough medicines, bandages. Things were not going that well. But there's another factor which is almost incomprehensible. Throughout that long, bloody, horrible war, most of the battles went on in France, which was one of the winners. Germany had no major battle whatsoever going on in its national boundaries. Nothing at all. The only thing that ever happened was right at the beginning of the war, the Tsar sent some totally ill-prepared troops to invade Germany for the sake of the Tsardom, and they were beaten back immediately, and that just, again, showed the strength. When Russia and Germany signed their separate peace treaty, 1 million miles of land was given to Germany. That's not a loser. Obviously, we're winning the war. And in fact, there was a significant battle late in 1917, early 18, where in the trench warfare that was mostly immobile, the Germans managed to move 13 miles into France. Nothing like that ever happened before or since in World War I, that kind of movement. And there again, the Kaiser announced this was a great victory and the war was coming to an end. When the German troops returned from the front in December and early January, they were cheered as conquerors. The at that time socialist chancellor of Germany gave the leaders of the German army the highest military awards. The heart of the German Empire was given to von Hindenburg. The last time they had been given to somebody was when Napoleon was conquered by the Germans many years before. So this was, as far as the Germans were concerned, they had won the war. It was only in January that they learned they had lost the war. And now they were going to be paying reparations according to the peace treaty. They took full responsibility for starting the war, which was a ridiculous lie. It was pretty much shared by everybody, all of the combatants. And they were going to lose land to France and to Italy. And they had to give all of their weapons up. And they had to pay billions of dollars so that the Allies could buy new weapons in case Germany ever declared war on them again. This was a huge surprise. And this is where the idea of what was called the stab in the back originated, that one of the German strategists said, our soldiers facing out, facing the enemy, are winning. The problem is they're getting stabbed in the back from within Germany. They're not allowed to fight as hard as they could. They're not given the supplies they need. They're not given the political support. And so this kind of ur-political conspiracy theory arose that it was the socialists, the communists, and the Jews who lost the war, not the Germans and not the German army, for sure, which created tremendous hatred. And now with the starvation that was going on, that only exacerbated all of these things.